This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 1st, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 123. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. And two items on the big deal feature. First, the Special Committee on Canada-China Relations heard from China watchers. And then, the Cullen Commission is underway. Testimony from participants in the first of three phases of British Columbia's money laundering public inquiry. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or was it a little bit humorous that the BC Liberal Party chose Leap Year Day to announce Rich Coleman was finally taking the leap and will not run for re-election? Nearly a quarter century as an MLA in Langley, Coleman spent 16 years in the BC Liberal government as minister in charge of BC Hydro, BC Housing, gambling, liquor, as well as Solicitor General. He is a target for the Cullen Commission on Money Laundering, expected to testify in the fall about why he shut down the RCMP's illegal gambling squad in 2009. There are too many questions about what Coleman knew and when he knew it, about the BC Rail privatization scandal, for instance, not to mention his longtime friendship with BC Liberal mastermind and lobbyist Patrick Kinsella. Coleman's nickname? Unavailable. That's what I was told every time I tried contacting his office while he was a cabinet minister. Like the time in 2012 when I broke the story about his role in an attempt to privatize the liquor distribution warehouses. On the eve of the 2017 election, Coleman evaded my questions outside a BC Liberal Cash for Access fundraiser. This is what it sounded like.
Hey, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Coleman. Bob Mackin, how are you?
Bob, how are you?
Great, great. Wonder if I can ask you a few questions. Do you want to stop for a moment and answer a few questions? Why not? Well, I've got you on camera here, and this election's coming up. The citizens would like to hear from you. You're the Deputy Premier.
Bob?
We'd like questions about BC housing.
Tonight, it's been a long day, and I'm going home.
You don't have 30 seconds to answer a few questions.
Not for you.
Not for me. Why, sir? I've been trying for a number of years to do an interview with you. I tried to do interviews with you about liquor distribution branch in 2012. No luck. I've called your media office. Always told no, you're not available. Minister Coleman, there are some serious questions about BC housing right now. What were you doing last year, February 23rd of last year, at the Wall Centre? What was that fundraiser about, sir? Peter Wall, Bruno Wall, $400,000?
Of course, I could understand why Coleman didn't want to give me the time of day. I revealed in fall 2016 leaked audio where he boasted that the party's coffers were overflowing, before the legislature session was cancelled so the party could do even more fundraising that fall. This is what he said at that meeting in Granville Island.
But I have to tell you this. We're fully funded for a campaign. Our ridings are in great shape. We've never been in the financial position we are. We've never been more organized before a campaign than we are at this start date today. We're far enough along with our candidates as we are at this start date. And 4 years ago at this time, we were 26 points behind. Think about it. 26 points behind. Even my oldest brother, who came to visit me in November, thought it was crazy to even think about running again because he said, you're going to lose, and I explained to him how we're going to win, and we did. So if he asked the question today, he would probably say, I'm not even going to debate with you. If you say you're going to win, you're going to win. I tell you what, with the candidates we're attracting, the organization we have, the work that we're doing, the training that we're doing for our campaign managers, the stuff that we have now on social media platforms and our computer platforms, and all the work that's getting done and how hard our candidates are working, I believe we'll have more seats after this election than we have today, after we come out of May 9, 2017.
Coleman's prediction of winning more seats in 2017 flopped. The party lost its majority when it lost four seats. Coleman later took over as interim leader when Christy Clark quit in the summer of 2017.
And Christy Clark, what she's given us, this province should never be forgiven.
But don't shed a tear for Coleman. He'll get $83,000 a year in taxpayer-funded pension. He's a walking, talking advertisement for why BC needs term limits. He was in office too long, with too much power, and too much secrecy. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Kok Shing-wei and Dewey Sim report, coronavirus, Southeast Asia supply chains feel the squeeze from COVID-19. Singapore was one of the first countries to implement a travel ban on January 29th when it restricted entry to travelers from Hubei province, the epicenter of the outbreak. Indonesia has about 30,000 Chinese workers employed in various plants and businesses in the country. In Myanmar, the typically busy office of Winner Global Logistics Services has workers sitting idle. The Philippines also has not been spared a drop-off, with the total volume of containers from China falling by 62.5% in the first 18 days of February. Meanwhile, goods from Thailand have been piling up in Chinese ports because of a lack of ground transport. Eric Johnston in the Japan Times, panic buying of made-in-China tissue, toilet paper erupts in some Japanese cities. Fears that COVID-19 could lead to shortages of daily items sparked incidents of stockpiling in Kumamoto. Residents on bicycles were filmed loaded down with toilet and tissue paper. The hoarding was apparently sparked by social media rumors that said stores were running short in both because they were made in China and would no longer be exported to Japan. Japan Household Paper Industry Association, a group of companies that makes toilet and tissue paper, said there were no problems with supplies. In 1973, after Arab countries embargoed oil exports to Japan, there were sometimes violent scenes of panicked buyers grabbing toilet paper. There were also buying sprees after the March 11, 2011 megaquake and tsunami. And Alex Rigglesworth in the Los Angeles Times, crane collapses at SoFi Stadium construction site in Inglewood. No one hurt. A crane that was being moved struck the boom of a stationary crane, causing that second crane to collapse. No injuries were reported. Video from the scene appeared to show the equipment fell into a dirt lot next to the stadium, not far from a parking lot. SoFi Stadium, the new 70,000-seat home of the Rams and Chargers, is set to open with a Taylor Swift concert in late July. At an estimated cost of $5 billion, it ranks as the priciest venue by far in NFL history. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Chris Talbot in the Seattle Times reports, longtime Seattle broadcaster Steve Rabel retiring from Cairo after more than three decades. The Cairo news anchor and Seattle Seahawks play-by-play man will retire from Cairo News later this spring. Rabel has had two day jobs as an adult, first as a Seattle Seahawks receiver and then as a TV anchor. The Louisville, Kentucky native was drafted by the expansion Seahawks in 1976 and played in the team's first win over Tampa Bay. He played 84 games overall during six seasons. The Nanaimo News Now reports, province spending $200,000 for one-day overdose and emergency response conference in Nanaimo. The Overdose Emergency Response Center conference in Nanaimo this spring or summer will share their experiences about the crisis that killed 1,000 people in BC in 2019. The conference is funded by $200,000 from the Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions, which also funds the community action teams. Ketia Slepian of Black Press reports, two law enforcement trucks deliberately set on fire in northern BC, RCMP say. Mounties are looking for suspects after two commercial vehicle safety and enforcement trucks were torched near Fort Nelson. Mounties believe both fires were deliberately set. Video evidence shows a person operating a snowmobile in the area at the time of both fires, RCMP said. And also these headlines in the Breaker.News this week. BMW Canada tells Cullen Commission that BC needs the return of ports police. Lawsuits allege fraud in Richmond and Regina. And David Sidhu's fraud trial tentatively set for January 2021. Plus, watch the Breaker.News for a developing story on the RCMP investigation of the NDP's Ginny Sims. A source tells me that the investigation is ending because of lack of evidence to support the allegations. The Public Prosecution Service and the RCMP have not confirmed or denied, nor have they released the reasons for the investigation. In May of last year, a whistleblower who worked in Sims' riding office said that Sims wrote visa reference letters for a group of Pakistani visitors. Three of them were on a U.S. government security watch list. Sims, who was Citizen Services Minister, has denied any wrongdoing. She quit cabinet but stays in caucus. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. The Special Committee on Canada-China Relations met February 24th in Ottawa. Members of all parties in the House of Commons heard testimony from China watchers in the world of academia. First, former diplomat Charles Burton is now an associate professor of political science at Brock University. Burton said Canada's weak diplomacy is failing and putting Canadian security at risk.
Troubling question for me in terms of our policy towards China is that if Canada accepts this idea that China values unity and the needs of society at large rather than freedom of individual choice, does that mean, for example, that Canada will stand idly by in the face of the horrendous and massive program of cultural genocide against the Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims in China, who are confined, as we know, to these so-called re-education camps where they're not permitted to practice their religion at any times over their years of incarceration? Previous witness did not know how many Uyghurs are incarcerated, but I can tell you that the U.S. State Department says 3 million, at least a million. Total population of Uyghurs in China is about 10 million. The other thing is, with regard to a response, which we're not making, is that Canada has put the names of officials from Sudan, Russia, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia on our Justice for Victims of Corrupt Foreign Officials Magnitsky list. But in sharp contrast, no Chinese officials complicit in the persecution of Tibetans, Uyghurs, Falun Gong, and Chinese Christians, democracy activists, and so on have been designated. I believe that this sends out a strong signal to the PRC regime by omission, and the signal is that hostage diplomacy and the arbitrary imposition of trade sanctions against Canada is a policy that works. Our lack of any substantive response to this emboldens the Chinese regime to do more of this kind of thing in future. Let me just say one last thing. My friend Anne-Marie Brady spoke to New Zealand's parliament inquiry on foreign influence earlier this year. She details the Chinese Communist Party's massive scheme of enticing foreign politicians, academics, and business people to promote China's agenda through political lobbying, the media, and academia. Besides offering business opportunities or free trips to China using bribery or honey traps and so on, there are also consultancies in which prominent advisors pocket up to $150,000 per annum just for being affiliated with PRC entities. So long as the foreign advisor promotes relations with China on PRC terms, the money keeps coming. I urge that we, the committee, look seriously at Australia's 2018 Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme Act. Canada needs to come to terms with Chinese money benefiting Canadian political campaigns and rewarding Canadian politicians and public servants who are seen as friends of China.
Also testifying at the Canada-China Relations Committee, Professor Paul Evans from the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia. Evans favors engagement with China.
Finally, a new frontier of the relationship is reacting to China's growing presence, influence, and occasional interference in Canada. A higher level of awareness and vigilance is needed to protect Canadian values and institutions at home. We need to do this without sensationalizing or exaggerating Chinese activities and their impact, without singularizing China as the only player in the influence and interference business, and without stigmatizing Chinese Canadians by calling into question their integrity and loyalty. How, for example, do we keep our doors open to Chinese students and to research exchanges in our universities while closing windows to protect intellectual property and national security in an era of technological competition with China and extraterritorial pressure from the United States?
Also on the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast this week, the Cullen Commission on Money Laundering in British Columbia. It's underway now. Testimony from participants in the first of three phases. As the inquiry opened February 24th in Vancouver at the federal court, Attorney General David Eby met the press in Victoria.
You mentioned Mike DeYoung could be a witness here. How many current or former Liberal MLAs do you believe should be witnesses for this commission?
The best part about an independent public inquiry is that, I know, but the best part about it is that the decisions about who should testify and who shouldn't are made by an independent commissioner. I have my own list of people who I believe can and should be testifying, including certainly MLA DeYoung, MLA Coleman, for their direct roles, but it's not up to me. There's a reason why we struck an independent public inquiry. It's up to the commissioner.
If you're making a list, is former Premier Christy Clark on your list?
I think, Christy Clark, Mike DeYoung, Rich Coleman, I think they should be glad I'm not the commissioner.
Anyone else?
Over the next 2.5 days, Commissioner Austin Cullen heard the opening statements from those granted participation status in the public inquiry. That includes lawyers from real estate, law societies, casino companies, and labor unions. Witness testimony and cross-examination begins after Labor Day. Transparency International Canada's James Cohen said the root of evil is the corruption by design, a lack of transparency in who owns what in Canada.
Snowwashing is not the only notorious term tied to Canada's money laundering problem. As the residents of British Columbia know all too well, and indeed what is the basis for this commission, there is also the term the Vancouver model, as reported by then Vancouver Sun journalist Sam Cooper. The term was coined by intelligence agencies based in our international partner governments to describe illicit flow funds connecting gambling in China and Vancouver, and in turn, linking that to underground banks, housing, and domestic crime in British Columbia. Canada recently fell 4 points to 12th place in Transparency International's Global Corruption Perception Index, landing behind peers such as Germany and Norway. The annual index pointed to Canada's snowwashing problem as one of the reasons for the downgrade. There are a number of gaps within Canada's anti-money laundering law, the proceeds of crime, money laundering, and terrorist financing, PCMLTFA. But our coalition, as well as many experts and international bodies, agree on a key problem: Canada's weak beneficial ownership regime. Not everyone who owns a secret company is a criminal. Thousands of legitimate shell companies operate in the country. But gaps in Canada's laws allow the true owners of companies to remain anonymous, giving criminals entry to our economy and communities where they do significant harm. The coalition recommends greater transparency of true owners of companies, known as beneficial owners, or ultimate beneficial owners. Making ownership information public can deter criminals from using anonymous companies to hide dirty money. Federal, provincial, and territorial governments already have business registries, which are updated daily as companies are created, dissolved, amalgamated, or undergo ownership, address, or other information changes. Beneficial ownership transparency would add information about the true owners of companies to existing business registries. While not all details are public, enough information is available to deter those who want to snowwash money through a Canadian company. Since the explosive 2016 Panama Papers leaks, the federal government has vowed to crack down on massive offshore tax avoidance and evasion. But Canada cannot tackle sophisticated global networks without strengthening secrecy laws at home. Until it lifts the veil on anonymous ownership, shell companies will be used for financial crimes, costing both federal, provincial, and territorial governments billions in lost revenues. How anonymous shell companies impact Canada's economy? Money laundering, and particularly beneficial ownership transparency, can at times seem like an abstract issue for many Canadians, predominantly on how they are affected. But from facilitating crime to housing affordability and business due diligence, Canada's snowwashing problem affects Canadians across many sectors and individuals. on organized crime and corruption. Money laundering facilitates organized crime, drug and sex trafficking, and the fentanyl crisis. Major cases of international tax evasion have been linked to anonymous entities in Canada, including the largest tax fraud operation in Russian history. For one example, between 2008 and 2013, Russian crime syndicates sprinkled illicit proceeds using entities they incorporated across Canada, from Ontario and New Brunswick to Alberta and BC.
Commissioner Austin Cullen wrapped up proceedings on February 26th. The Cullen Commission returns in late May for subject matter experts.
As I noted in the introductory statement, the Commission's mandate is both broad and deep, and we need the assistance of all levels of government, the public and private agencies, and individual citizens to grapple with the many issues, some of them complex, to achieve a successful outcome for this commission. The participants' efforts in identifying issues, positions, and ideas for the commission to engage with as we move forwards and into the evidentiary phase of our hearings will provide significant assistance. We're very grateful for the participants' willingness to engage, your cooperation, and the benefit of your various perspectives as we develop and crystallize our approach towards the challenging and important issues which confront us. Did you have anything you wish to add, Mr. Martin?
No, and just as a reminder that we resume May 25th with a block of hearings scheduled until June 26th. Further hearings then start just after Labor Day through the fall.
Thank you. We will adjourn then.
Thank you.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the Militant Mothers of Raymuir. Thanks to the CBC's Karen Larson for her story about the mothers who blocked the CPR railway in East Vancouver in 1971, they were worried about the safety of their sons and daughters going to and from Seymour School. The federal government eventually built the Kiefer Street Rail Overpass, which was recently renamed for the Militant Mothers of Raymuir. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 1st, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on March 1st in 1974, a grand jury indicted the Watergate 7 for conspiring to obstruct the investigation of the biggest political scandal in American history? President Richard Nixon was an unindicted co-conspirator. But just over 5 months later, Nixon resigned. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.